Well, thanks for being here. It's always great to see who the righteous few who will show up on retreat weekend. Those who are dedicated enough that they will be here for our assembly, even when the A team is away and you're going to have to listen to a sermon from a retread preacher. So we have a mutual appreciation here for one another this morning because the thoughts that I have prepared. I just want to urge you to pay attention to something that it would be easy to overlook in today's markings or in the area outside of our assembly as you're moving toward the parking lot. And that is that we are in the middle of a sweater drive for Ukraine. Most of you know that for a number of years, I was president of Eastern European Mission and had a headquarters building in Donetsk, Ukraine. And from there, we worked across the entire country in both humanitarian and mission efforts, from the Crimea in the southeast to the Carpathian Mountains in the northwest. And during that time, it was my privilege to be the escort when David and Margie Vanderpool made their first trip to Ukraine country. And David came over to do the training for surgeons in a hospital in Ivano-Frankivsk out in western Ukraine. While they were there, they were introduced to the orphanages of Ukraine. And it changed them as it changes any of us who experience the conditions under which orphans lived then and still live in that country. And so it ignited a passion in them to do something about that. They came back to the States, and as many of you know, for the better part of two decades now, they have raised money for all kinds of humanitarian efforts across that country. Now, I say that to also say that you think you've been in cold weather until you go to Ukraine. Keep in mind that its latitude is well into football season. I lost two employees while I was leading that effort. One, a young lady who was run over by a runaway bus just outside our office. The other, a woman who was really like a daughter to me. I groomed her for years to become the national director. And just as she was ready to step into that role, died of a brain aneurysm at 37. Those weddings, those funerals were both in January, and as is common in Ukraine, the funeral is outdoors. You walk to the cemetery, perhaps several kilometers, and then you have a lengthy set of ceremonies at the funeral home, burial site. I wore thick sole shoes and three layers of socks. And my feet didn't thaw out for 3 days. It is bitterly cold in that country. And so a sweater drive sounds interesting when we hear about one. In Ukraine, it's life-saving. Right now, with the further deprivations of the war, I urge you, if you've got any sweater that, like some of mine, have gotten a little snug. I noticed it happened the same time the belts got a little short. We're going to pull together the ones that still have life in them and pitch them in to the giving effort here. So let me encourage you to join us in that. Love this couple, love the Ukrainians, love the work, love this project. I want to invite you to be part of it. In April of 1973, we made the move from work with the Broadway Church of Christ in Paducah, Kentucky, to the work that would take up most of the following decade with the Campbell Church of Christ in suburban San Jose, California. I was driving all of our belongings out in a U-Haul, and it really was not a very good one. And so I decided I would make the desert portion of the drive through through the night. Get some break in the temperature, at least. And so, about 3 o'clock in the morning, I'm on a long desert stretch between Albuquerque and Flagstaff, listening to an AM radio that is almost as underpowered as the air conditioning. And I can finally tune in only one station in a particularly long stretch that I can retain the station for more than about 10 seconds. It just so happened, it was a Christian station. And some local preacher up in Colorado was holding forth. And he began his sermon by asking, "What is the most misunderstood word in the Christian vocabulary?" He thought he would hold our attention by being a bit suspenseful about that. So he went on for 10, 11, 12 minutes teasing us about what the answer was. But having nothing else to do, that gave me sufficient time to formulate my own, which you will not be surprised was love. I had come to a different conclusion. I had concluded that the most misunderstood word in our Christian vocabulary is the word hope. We don't talk about it very much, at least not directly. There's no better known phrase in our vocabulary than faith, hope, and love. We have lots of songs about faith and lots of songs about love. Readily name me a dozen songs about hope. We don't write songs about it. When we begin to look at how we use this word, it's really degenerated in our day-to-day speech to mean something not much more than wishful thinking. If my team that I support is having a bottom of the rankings record at mid-season, it comes time for the All-Star break. Some of us are sitting around talking about the baseball season. I say, I hope they turn it around the last half of the season and win the pennant. You ask, do you really expect them to? Nah, but I hope they do. How many times have you heard somebody say, I hope to be out of debt this year? Oh, what's your plan? You think you're going to make it? Nah, probably won't, but I hope I can. Isn't it interesting how that word hope has lost its oomph? But Paul thought the word hope was life and destiny changing. And I want you to leave this morning with that sense yourself. We're going to look at three passages. Passages that if you came like I do from a family in which as a child you were made to memorize scripture, these were on the list. But I want to do more than just project them this morning. We're going to spend some time making commentary about them. Because within the simple language of these verses, we see the dynamic of what. The first one is going to come from the Apostle Paul in the book of Romans. An intriguing book really set the theme for the whole Protestant Reformation because of Luther's love for this section of Scripture. In the first three chapters, the theme is condemnation. In chapter one, the most scathing indictment of Gentile immorality that comes down to us from the ancient world. In the second chapter, an equally candid and accusatory indictment of the Jews. And in the third chapter, the universal indictment of all of us, because at verse 23 he says, we all have sinned and fallen short of the glory of God. And with that, he drops a pebble in the water that's going to ripple through the rest of the book. As he talks about glory and the glory that is to be revealed in us in chapter 8. But before he gets there, in chapters 4 and 5, he turns from the theme of condemnation to the themes of justification. And there he gives us that famous phrase, being justified by faith. And as we then progress further, and he talks about the work of faith in our life, he sets the stage for the 8th chapter, where glorification is going to come into the picture, but interwoven with the idea of our hope of glory. Intriguingly, he tees up the first verse we're going to look at today by talking about suffering. The whole world is groaning together, he said, in its suffering. And then he adds, and not only the non-believers, we ourselves groan in eager anticipation of the glory that will be revealed in us. And with that, he tees up that oft-quoted 24th verse, Romans 24. Here we're going to make our first pause as we look at the scriptures this morning. When, having said in faith, he will now say, we are saved in hope. The 24th verse, in hope we have been saved, justified by faith, saved in hope. But then he adds, though we are saved by hope, hope that is seen is not hope. For why does one also hope for what he sees? But if we hope for what we do not see, with perseverance, we wait eagerly for it. When I've taught classes over the years about perseverance in suffering, and have asked people, what are the key elements that go into being able to persevere? I get all kinds of answers. Maintaining a spiritual outlook. Praying a lot. But very rarely does someone say, keeping your hope vibrant. Paul says it is the vibrance of our hope that allows us to persevere when the suffering is unthinkable and seemingly unbearable. It is not a lightweight word. It is a substantive element of what gives us the ability to be Christian in our outlook, Christian in our attitude, Christian in our behavior, no matter what. In fact, through my life, I've increasingly come to appreciate the power of hope to help people cope with the unthinkable. As a young intelligence officer, I was tapped to be part of a 7-member team to debrief POWs who would return from the Hanoi Hilton when the war was over in Vietnam. I ended up working with 7 prisoners who were there long-term and had gone through horrendous abuse. In the 2 years that I was preparing for that assignment, because we didn't know when the war would be over and when we would be called into service in that regard, I went back and reread everything I could find on the experience of prisoners who were held in horrid conditions as political or military POWs. And as I read that, I kept seeing recurring stories, people bearing up under the unbearable because they had not lost hope. And I went back and I read and reread a book that has really been one of the shaping influences in my life since I first read it at about 15 or 16 years of age. It's not so well known nor so widely read today. But in my youth, everyone who was in the book, it's Viktor Frankl's Man's Search for Meaning. If Frankl is unfamiliar to you, he was one of the pioneers in modern psychiatry. Living in Vienna, a good friend of Sigmund Freud, rounded up in the earliest Nazi occupation effort to deport all Jews to concentration camps. The people on the train that brought him there were killed within the first 3 hours, summarily executed. He was kept alive because he was a medical doctor. And the Nazis thought maybe he could be of some help in treating prisoners within the camp. But they never gave him anything more than an occasional tin of aspirin. And so his medical practice was one of fundamentally a bedside manner of listening and caring and sympathizing, trying to give people some reason to hang on. One of the things he immediately noticed is that there were some people who, despite all the deprivations, managed to thrive in that horrid set of conditions, while others who had not been particularly abused and had not been in prison that long and still were carrying a considerable amount of body weight would give up hope, sit down in a corner, and soon die. He realized they were willing themselves to death because they had no hope. And then one day, as he was making his rounds at the bedside of a man who had been unable to get out of bed, "Doctor, I had a dream last night. In the dream, an angel appeared. And the angel said I could have the answer to any one question I wanted to ask. So what question was important to me? I asked the angel, when will the war be over for me? I don't remember the exact date, and I failed to go back and retrieve it. Let's just take March 24th as a reference date for the story. The angel told me the war will be over on March 24th for me. Now, I don't know what you believe about such things, doctor, but I believe that was a message from God telling me that the Allies are going to liberate our camp on March 24th. Frankl says an amazing thing happened with that individual. Already malnourished, already weak and disease-ridden, he started gaining strength. He started moving about the camp. He became someone who was always at Frankl's side, attending to people. He was helping other people restore their spirits, renew their determination to live. Frankl said he became a peacemaker in the camp. He became a leader. But he said, on March 22nd, as we were making our rounds, I noticed he was distracted. Because no matter what he was doing, he was straining his ear to see if he could hear the inevitable approaching thump, thump, thump of the Allied artillery. We heard nothing. And he said, on March 24th, he didn't make rounds with me. I found him sitting outside a hut in something of a fetal ball. And he looked up at me and said, "Doctor, it was a lie. They are not coming." And on March 24th, the war was over for that man. Because he simply willed himself out of existence. The only thing that changed was he lost his hope. No longer persevere. Now, that kind of hope has to have a foundation to stand on. So the second passage from Hebrews chapter 11, verse 1. In which we are told, now faith is what? Many of you can quote it. Faith is, the modern translations say something like, the assurance of things hoped for. The conviction of things not seen. Occasionally, the old King James Version, with its now archaic language, chooses a term that is really the right term for a verse. And this is one of those cases. In Hebrews chapter 11, the King James Version says, from those of you who memorized it from that version, faith is the substance of things hoped for. Faith is what gives substance to our hope. It's not wishful thinking. It's not pie in the sky daydreaming. There is substance underneath our hope. And interestingly, the word substance in English exactly equates to the Greek term in the original text. Because if you look at the word substance, it means to stand under, stance, sub, stand under a thing. And the word hupotasso, the Greek term, is exactly the same word. It is to stand under a thing. Our hope is not free-floating. It's not groundless. It has faith standing under it, holding it up. And that faith, however, is built on things that are not seen. We live in a world in which we but let the scientific mindset take over our thought process so much that if we can't see it and measure it and taste it and smell it, it's considered not scientific. It doesn't really exist. And I've had atheists argue that with me on campuses at Berkeley and Stanford and other places where I've been making presentations on behalf of the Christian worldview. But even they believe that there is evidence of things you can't measure, you cannot calibrate with scientific instruments. It's called the unconscious mind. I'm yet to meet a scientist who doesn't believe in the unconscious mind. Have you ever weighed one? How wide is it? That it exists, but it is beyond our physical abilities to grasp, not beyond our mental abilities to grasp. And that faith that we have is built on the evidence we have that there is an unseen world. There are angels. There is a glory that is coming that we have a promised stake in. And therefore, we can persevere, which takes us back to something else I'm not sure you noticed in that first verse we touched on. It is not only that we persevere while waiting for it. Waiting in the suffering, waiting in the distress, waiting in the uncertainty about the future. With perseverance, we wait. How do you know when someone has given up hope? It is when they start saying, "I can't wait any longer. I'm going to meet you for lunch." And it's at a restaurant that's some distance away from both of us. I get there 5 minutes early, violating all of my habits, I get there early. I get there early, 10 minutes past our meeting time, you're not there, 15, 20. I've gone through a couple of cups of coffee. I've told the waitress now three times, I'm sure he'll be here. I trust this person. But at some point, I will say, I had hoped to have lunch with him, but I can't wait any longer, and I will make my departure. Waiting patiently is the essence of hope. And if I'm so distressed by what's happening in my life and to my life that I'm getting the sense that I just can't wait any longer, the problem is in a faith that's not sufficiently strong enough that it's holding up that hope. And then these two words get tied together in 1 Corinthians 13:13, in perhaps one of the best known passages in Christian scripture. Now, abide faith, hope, and love. These three. And the greatest of these is love. You see, in English, we emphasize the importance of a word in a sentence by putting it at the end. The whole sentence builds up to, boom, the powerful point we want to make at the end of the sentence. In Greek, it's just the opposite. If you really want to emphasize something, you put it at the first. And that's what Paul does with his construction in this sentence. He's talked about all these things that are transitory, all these things that are going to go away. In Greek, the tone is, that's going away, this is going away, that's going to dissolve. But the abiding things, he puts that word abiding at the very first. The abiding things, the things that will not go away, are faith, hope, and love. Now think about that sequence. What happened to Frankel's friend in the camp? Once he got hope, he became a loving fellow prisoner. He could sacrifice self and well-being for the needs of others. But as soon as hope faded because he lost faith in the word of the angel in the dream, he no longer had the stuff within him to practice love. So the problem is not that we have a world that is too unloving. We have a world in which we've lost too much hope. Because if we really believe in that unseen world and the promise of the glory that shall be revealed in us, we can with patience wait for it, and while waiting, be an exemplar of the love of Christ. Let's stand and sing.